Now, regard the counterpart from the unconscious. One of my patients, writes Dr. C. G. Jung, dreamt that a snake shot out of a cave and bit him in the genital region. This dream occurred at the moment when the patient was convinced of the truth of the analysis and was beginning to free himself from the bonds of his mother complex. It has always been the prime function of mythology and rite to supply the symbols that carry the human spirit forward, in counteraction to those constant human fantasies that tend to tie it back. In fact, it may well be that the very high incidence of neuroticism among ourselves follows from the decline among us of such effective spiritual aid. We remain fixated to the unexercised images of our infancy, and hence disinclined to the necessary passages of our adulthood. In the United States, there is even a pathos of inverted emphasis. The goal is not to grow old, but to remain young, not to mature away from mother, but to cleave to her. And so, while husbands are worshiping at their boyhood shrines, being the lawyers, merchants, or masterminds their parents wanted them to be, their wives, even after 14 years of marriage and two fine children, produced and raised, are still on the search for love, which can come to them only from the centaurs, Cyllini, satyrs, and other concupiscent incubi of the route of Pan, either as in the second of the above-recited dreams, or as in our popular, vanilla-frosted temples of the venereal goddess, under the makeup of the latest heroes of the screen. The psychoanalyst has to come along, at last, to assert again the tried wisdom of the older, forward-looking teachings of the masked medicine dancers and the witch-doctor circumcisers, whereupon we find, as in the dream of the serpent bite, that the ageless initiation symbolism is produced spontaneously by the patient himself at the moment of the release. Apparently, there is something in these initiatory images so necessary to the psyche that if they are not supplied from without, through myth and ritual, they will have to be announced again, through dream, from within, lest our energies should remain locked in a banal, long-outmoded toy room at the bottom of the sea. Sigmund Freud stresses in his writings the passages and difficulties of the first half of the human cycle of life, those of our infancy and adolescence, when our sun is mounting toward its zenith. C.G. Jung, on the other hand, has emphasized the crises of the second portion, when, in order to advance, the shining sphere must submit to descend and disappear, at last, into the night womb of the grave. The normal symbols of our desires and fears become converted, in this afternoon of the biography, into their opposites. For it is then no longer life but death that is the challenge. What is difficult to leave, then, is not the womb but the phallus, unless, indeed, the life weariness has already seized the heart, when it will be death that calls with the promise of bliss that formerly was the lure of love. Full circle, from the tomb of the womb to the womb of the tomb we come, an ambiguous, enigmatical incursion into a world of solid matter that is soon to melt from us, like the substance of a dream. And, looking back at what had promised to be our own unique, unpredictable, and dangerous adventure, all we find in the end is such a series of standard metamorphoses as men and women have undergone in every quarter of the world, in all recorded centuries, and under every odd disguise of civilization. The story is told, for example, of the great Minos, king of the island empire of Crete in the period of its commercial supremacy, how he hired the celebrated artist-craftsman Daedalus to invent and construct for him a labyrinth in which to hide something of which the palace was at once ashamed and afraid. For there was a monster on the premises, which had been born to Pasiphae, the queen. Minos, the king, had been busy, it is said, with important wars to protect the trade routes, and meanwhile Pasiphae had been seduced by a magnificent snow-white sea-born bull. It had been nothing worse, really, than what Minos' own mother had allowed to happen. Minos' mother was Europa, and it is well known that she was carried by a bull to Crete. The bull had been the god Zeus, and the honored son of that sacred union was Minos himself, now everywhere respected and gladly served. How, then, could Pasiphae have known that the fruit of her own indiscretion would be a monster, this little son with human body, but the head and tail of a bull? Society has blamed the queen greatly, but the king was not unconscious of his own share of guilt. The bull in question had been sent by the god Poseidon long ago, when Minos was contending with his brothers for the throne. Minos had asserted that the throne was his, by divine right, and had prayed the god to send up a bull out of the sea as a sign. And he had sealed the prayer with a vow to sacrifice the animal immediately as an offering and symbol of service. The bull had appeared, and Minos took the throne. But when he beheld the majesty of the beast that had been sent and thought what an advantage it would be to possess such a specimen, he determined to risk a merchant's substitution, of which he supposed the god would take no great account. Offering on Poseidon's altar the finest white bull that he owned, he added the other to his herd. The Cretan Empire had greatly prospered under the sensible jurisdiction of this celebrated lawgiver and model of public virtue. Knossos, the capital city, became the luxurious, elegant center of the leading commercial power of the civilized world. The Cretan fleets went out to every isle and harbor of the Mediterranean. Cretan ware was prized in Babylonia and Egypt. The bold little ships even broke through the gates of Hercules to the open ocean, coasting then northward to take the gold of Ireland and the tin of Cornwall, as well as southward, around the bulge of Senegal, to remote Yoruba land and the distant marts of ivory, gold, and slaves. But at home, the queen had been inspired by Poseidon with an ungovernable passion for the bull, and she had prevailed upon her husband's artist craftsman, the peerless Daedalus, to frame for her a wooden cow that would deceive the bull, into which she eagerly entered. And the bull was deceived. She bore her monster, which, in due time, began to become a danger. And so Daedalus again was summoned, this time by the king, to construct a tremendous labyrinthine enclosure with blind passages in which to hide the thing away. So deceptive was the invention that Daedalus himself, when he had finished it, was scarcely able to find his way back to the entrance. Therein the Minotaur was settled, and he was fed thereafter on groups of living youths and maidens, carried as tribute from the conquered nations within the Cretan domain. Thus, according to the ancient legend, the primary fault was not the queen's, but the king's, and he could not really blame her, for he knew what he had done. He had converted a public event to personal gain, whereas the whole sense of his investiture as king had been that he was no longer a mere private person. The return of the bull should have symbolized his absolutely selfless submission to the functions of his role. The retaining of it represented, on the other hand, an impulse to egocentric self-aggrandizement. And so the king, by the grace of God, became the dangerous tyrant hold fast, out for himself. Just as the traditional rites of passage used to teach the individual to die to the past and be reborn to the future, so the great ceremonials of investiture divested him of his private character and clothed him in the mantle of his vocation. Such was the ideal, whether the man was a craftsman or a king. By the sacrilege of the refusal of the rite, however, the individual cut himself as a unit off from the larger unit of the whole community. And so the one was broken into the many, and these then battled each other, each out for himself, and could be governed only by force. The figure of the tyrant monster is known to the mythologies, folk traditions, legends, and even nightmares of the world. And his characteristics are everywhere essentially the same. He is the hoarder of the general benefit. He is the monster avid for the greedy rights of my and mine. The havoc wrought by him is described in mythology and fairy tale as being universal throughout his domain. This may be no more than his household, his own tortured psyche, or the lives that he blights with the touch of his friendship and assistance. Or it may amount to the extent of his civilization. The inflated ego of the tyrant is a curse to himself and his world, no matter how his affairs may seem to prosper. Self-terrorized, fear-haunted, alert at every hand to meet and battle back the anticipated aggressions of his environment, which are primarily the reflections of the uncontrollable impulses to acquisition within himself. The giant of self-achieved independence is the world's messenger of disaster, even though, in his mind, he may entertain himself with humane intentions. Wherever he sets his hand, there is a cry, if not from the housetops, then, more miserably, within every heart, a cry for the redeeming hero, the carrier of the shining blade, whose blow, whose touch, whose existence will liberate the land.
Here one can neither stand, nor lie, nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland.
The hero is the man of self-achieved submission. But submission to what? That, precisely, is the riddle that today we have to ask ourselves, and that it is everywhere the primary virtue and historic deed of the hero to have solved. As Professor Arnold J. Toynbee indicates in his six-volume study of the laws of the rise and disintegration of civilizations, schism in the soul, schism in the body social, will not be resolved by any scheme of return to the good old days, archaism, or by the programs guaranteed to render an ideal projected future, futurism, or even by the most realistic, hard-headed work to weld together again the deteriorating elements. Only birth can conquer death. The birth, not of the old thing again, but of something new. Within the soul, within the body social, there must be, if we are to experience long survival, a continuous recurrence of birth. Palingenesia, to nullify the unremitting recurrences of death. For it is by means of our own victories, if we are not regenerated, that the work of Nemesis is wrought. Doom breaks from the shell of our very virtue. Peace, then, is a snare. War is a snare. Change is a snare. Permanence a snare. When our day is come for the victory of death, death closes in. There is nothing we can do except be crucified and resurrected, dismembered totally, and then reborn. Theseus, the hero slayer of the Minotaur, entered Crete from without as the symbol and arm of the rising civilization of the Greeks. That was the new and living thing. But it is possible also for the principle of regeneration to be sought and found within the very walls of the tyrant's empire itself. Professor Toynbee uses the terms detachment and transfiguration to describe the crisis by which the higher spiritual dimension is attained that makes possible the resumption of the work of creation. The first step, detachment or withdrawal, consists in a radical transfer of emphasis from the external to the internal world, macro to microcosm, a retreat from the desperations of the wasteland to the peace of the everlasting realm that is within. But this realm, as we know from psychoanalysis, is precisely the infantile unconscious. It is the realm that we enter in sleep. We carry it within ourselves forever. All the ogres and secret helpers of our nursery are there. All the magic of childhood. And more important, all the life potentialities that we never managed to bring to adult realization, those other portions of ourself are there. For such golden seeds do not die. If only a portion of that lost totality could be dredged up into the light of day, we should experience a marvelous expansion of our powers, a vivid renewal of life. We should tower in stature. Moreover, if we could dredge up something forgotten, not only by ourselves, but by our whole generation or our entire civilization, we should become indeed the boon bringer, the culture hero of the day, a personage of not only local, but world historical moment. In a word, the first work of the hero is to retreat from the world scene of secondary effects to those causal zones of the psyche where the difficulties really reside, and there to clarify the difficulties, eradicate them in his own case, i.e., give battle to the nursery demons of his local culture, and break through to the undistorted direct experience and assimilation of what C.G. Jung has called the archetypal images. This is the process known to Hindu and Buddhist philosophy as viveka, discrimination.